From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt. Our compatriot, our better third, is on a bit of an adventure, but he will return shortly.
Oh, better third? Crucial third.
Crucial third.
In the meantime, they call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul, Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. A little bit of true crime today, Matt.
Yeah, very true and very crime.
Yes, and very much ongoing. So, longtime listeners will remember that back in the day, we had Alex Winter on this show.
That's right.
Do you remember that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. It was one of my favorite interviews we've ever done. One of the Bill and Ted of the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and what was the other one? The
Bogus Journey.
Bogus Journey. Yeah.
Bogus Journey featuring Death.
But he's not just some silly young kid running through time and trying to finish papers for a history class. No, that gentleman, Alex Winter, he is a documentarian, and he has put out some great work. One was on the deep web or the dark net, and that's what we interviewed him for.
And this guy... incredibly nice, very generous with his time.
Loves Hot Pockets.
I think that's still my favorite part of the interview. Did that make it onto the air?
I don't know if it did.
I think we may have cut that part. There was a part in the interview just backstage, off mic. It was probably off mic because we're professionals now or whatever.
Yeah.
He said, hang on, guys. He was making a very good point about something. He said, hold on, hold on, hold on. I said, what? And then we hear ding in the background. He's like, I'm making Hot Pockets.
Like, don't eat him. It's too hot yet. Y'all, just wait. Wait for a second.
Yeah. The waiting was the worst part, but we really bonded. Yeah. He did Deep Web, which was a fascinating exploration of something that I think a lot of people get wrong when they read about it in the news. But that is far from his only film. He also released a documentary recently on the Panama Papers.
Yes, the Panama Papers. This is a topic that we've done an episode on before in the past. It was called Money, Mystery, and Millionaires.
That was a very alliterative phase for us.
Yeah, it was. But the Panama Papers is a very serious thing. It was a leak, the largest leak in human history.
Something around 11.5 million files from dating back to the 70s to 2015 or so. That's 2.6 terabytes of data detailing these secret financial relationships and attorney-client privileged information, the kind of stuff you would never ordinarily see.
Yeah, it was you're talking about shell companies and offshore accounts and secret just money moving, almost laundering, almost.
In some cases, it was definitely laundering.
Yes.
So this all comes from a law firm in Panama called Mossack Fonseca.
Yep, that's the one. And so you might wonder, well, why on earth would someone at Mossack Fonseca send out that much information? Well, there was a person who was identified as John Doe. They were given to a German newspaper by this anonymous person. And then there was a landslide, essentially a very secretive landslide of information and people investigating kind of in the shadows, because this seemed like very dangerous stuff to have.
Indeed. Indeed it did, because this involves over 200,000 different offshore entities. And this John Doe... spoiler alert, folks, that's probably not this person's real name.
Gonna go ahead and say I probably agree.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't ordinarily profile. But this character, this John Doe person, said that they themselves feared for their lives because the nature of the evidence, just the facts, the information that's involved in this leak – in some cases, it confirmed long suspected crimes. We know this person is maybe doing something very white collar, like tax avoidance.
Yeah.
But we can't We can't quite prove it. We can't quite follow the money due to different different countries' ways of handling financial transactions. That's a big thing.
Yes. And these types of financial transactions, a lot of times in our minds, I think collectively, we think of this as something that maybe a drug lord would participate in, maybe somebody who is doing some kind of illegal activity that needs to, like we said, launder money for some reason. But what we found out in these Panama Papers is that these kinds of activities are just kind of par for the course for anyone who has enough money.
Yeah, above a certain threshold, it is normalized to engage in these sorts of practices. And in our previous episode, which you absolutely should listen to if you haven't checked it out yet, in our previous episode, we explore how the German paper came to find the safest way to disseminate and analyze this info. Yeah. We also found just how many people had been, to your point, Matt, how many people had been named. These financial movements through shell companies involve athletes, involve bankers, involve criminals, you know, as in like drug cartel overlords and stuff. But it also involves politicians. British Prime Minister David Cameron was implicated in this.
Yeah.
And the Icelandic Prime Minister, Sigmundur Gunnlaugsson, had to resign. I believe he ultimately stepped down. Also, a lot of these transactions that we see, moving money from one shell company to another to get the best tax position, that stuff's legal.
Yeah.
It's a legal thing.
And what are you going to do about it?
Right.
I mean, it's just we're the big players of the world and this is what we're doing. If it's proven to be tax avoidance, then it's illegal. Mm-hmm. If it's just moving money around to make sure it's safe in Switzerland somewhere or Panama, it's fine.
Sure, it's just gambling, and you know, Vegas, baby. That's probably what people say.
That's what they all say in Panama, Vegas, baby.
That's what they all say in the country of Panama.
Yeah,
they all say Vegas, baby. Why is this a big deal, though? If these things are legal, if it's just a depiction of a confidential yet still legal financial process, what gives? Where's the beef?
Well, because not all of it is legal.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. In multiple cases, the transactions indicate some pretty heavy stuff. Perhaps most importantly, the Panama Papers show the clear process through which these sorts of financial crimes occur. It's possible, using this information, to follow money from point A to B to C to Z and so on. That is in itself extraordinary. So from a criminal perspective, this exposes a large industry built entirely to hide money, whether it's a legal form of tax avoidance, whether it's out-and-out fraud, whether it's bribery disguised as a loan, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting the nail on the head here, Ben. It's not even so much about the players that are essentially the clients moving money. It's about the system, like the Mossack Fonseca, that was built to do this thing. The giant, I don't know what we call it, the machine that ends up processing everything. That can be dangerous.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too. So, for instance, let's go with an automobile analogy.
Okay.
All right. So, the people riding in the car are the people named in these transactions.
Got it. Okay?
Gasoline or petrol or whatever is the money.
Just got to pump it in. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And what the Panama Papers showed us was the engine. It took us under the hood. And so we see how the money moves. And we know it takes these people to certain places, right? I don't want to overthink this comparison.
Maybe the passengers are the money.
Okay.
The engine is the machine that's moving it to somewhere because the money is going places, right?
Yeah, okay.
Then
and you're spending money to do it.
Yes, okay. That's right. So okay. The money is also the gas.
Okay. Let's get a whiteboard. Paul, do we have a whiteboard?
Wait. Paul's been writing all of this down. He's just been etching it into the wall.
Oh wow.
That's very helpful.
That's
we
great.
Are going to have to replace that though, Paul.
Jeez. No, it needs to be transparent. This terrible comparison we've created should exist for all time. It wasn't that bad. I thought it was okay.
It was great.
But the release of these papers was not great for the folks involved. It was not all sunshine and rainbows on their end.
No, absolutely. And you can kind of feel that Ben and I are having fun in the studio, and this is one of those topics that is going to get very heavy. We just, I think that's something that Ben, you and I do when we're talking about something that's pretty heavy. Mm. Just give a little lightness to it, but prepare yourself.
That's true. That's true. This is a bit of the I used to call it the NPR story formula, but it's not really NPR. It's more programs that are on NPR, like The Moth or something. So what you do is you start out with a lighthearted statement or something very bold in one sentence.
Got it.
And then you save the heavy stuff for the turn at the end. And this is where we're approaching the turn to our second half, folks, because when that German paper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, received the original leak and they realized the size of the stuff they were dealing with, they started, as you said, Matt, secretly asking for help throughout the journalistic community.
Yes.
Because we need multiple sources to confirm this stuff is true. First off, do we know this is even real? If so, how? That's a long, arduous, tedious process. And John Doe complicated it because John Doe, fearing for their life, had certain conditions.
Yeah. He could only communicate with them and them back through encrypted channels, which is, I would say, kind of standard for this kind of thing. It's very Edward Snowden in a way, almost like digitally putting your cell phone in the freezer. They could also never meet face to face, so neither side would know exactly, I guess, who they were talking to. Well, in this case, I'm sure John Doe knew some of the names of the journalists. And you can definitely see through his actions just how scared this John Doe was about his actions and about the power that these papers held.
And as of today, we still know very, very little about this individual or this group of people pretending to be an individual. We simply know that they treated this situation with enormous gravity, and we still publicly don't know their motivation for disseminating this knowledge. But as it turns out, John Doe, whoever he or she or they may be, was absolutely correct. This was indeed a life or death situation. And the story continued after we did our original episode. So what do we mean when we say life or death? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy. We'd like to introduce you to Daphne Caruana Galizia.
She was born August 26th, 1964. She was a Maltese journalist. She was an author and an activist, and she was also a prolific blogger. She's basically the, you could call her a classic trope of the no excuses, I'm going to tell truth to power, investigative journalist, essentially, just functioning on her own and with organizations. But definitely you could read her passion for that kind of stuff in her blog. And if you're interested in it right now, you can, like, as we're talking about
this.
It's
still up, yeah.
Yeah, you can go over there. Let me just pull it up really fast. The website is Daphne, D-A-P-H-N-E, Caruana, C-A-R-U-A-N-A, Galiza, G-A-L-I-Z-I-A.com. And you can go there right now and you can just see all of these posts that she made. And like I said, you can see her passion.
And she spent decades building her reputation in Malta and abroad, primarily for investigations into what she saw as the corruption-riddled government, society, and industry of Malta. She examined things like the link between Malta's online gambling and organized crime, or something called the Citizenship by Investment Scheme, also known as Golden Visas. And this one was an interesting one because this happens in a ton of countries. This happens in the US. This happens in the UK. If you pay a certain amount of money or you – by paying, we mean in some cases if you invest in a company or something at a certain amount of money, maybe $100,000 – Probably more.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's a good starting point.
And then you get residency and eventually you get citizenship. This is a legal thing. It's of course, it's incredibly unfair.
Yeah.
Most citizenship requests that are granted every year are not this. This is a wealthy person's loophole.
Yes.
Right? So the problem with it happening in Malta is that because they're a member of the EU, there was concern that they were essentially selling passports to people who would be maybe unfriendly to the West.
Got it.
But because they had an EU passport, they could do things like travel to the US without a visa.
No.
And they could also launder some money as well, because with citizenship comes certain rights.
Yes, she was on the trail of all kinds of money laundering throughout her career. And also, you know, kind of some other standard things like nepotism within government, within corporations, government corruption, which is an old standby.
Yes, especially in Malta.
Yeah. She was really speaking truth to power.
And she paid for it. Malta is not a large nation.
That's right.
A lot of people know each other. She was the target of intimidation, lawsuits, threats of lawsuits for libel and so on for most of her career.
Yeah.
She was arrested by the Malta police force twice. Someone set the front door of their house on fire in 96.
Yeah. That's really bad. The worst one is that the family dog, her family's dog, had its throat cut and it was laid across her doorstep.
And then another dog got shot, I believe.
Yeah.
So there was a murder attempt on her life in 2006. The house was set on fire while the family was asleep inside. And according to her son, Matthew, these threats occurred on an almost daily basis. So this is a very high-stakes life. Every day, thousands and thousands of people are following her blog, running commentary. And she's also a regular contributor and columnist for the Sunday Times of Malta and the Malta Independent.
And just to point that out, what Ben just said there, the running commentary is the name of the blog that we mentioned earlier.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The website is www.daphnecarunagalizia.com, but the name of it is Running Commentary. So far, we've painted the picture of a fascinating journalist, right, and the largest leak in human history that we know of. How are they related other than just accurate journalism? They're related because it turns out that Galizia was the first person to learn about Panamanian companies involved in various crimes by Maltese nationals.
Yeah. And specifically politicians.
Specifically politicians, active politicians, politicians in power. And she had put these pieces together before the Panama Papers leaked. They were transmitted to the German paper in 2015. They went public in 2016. But she had figured out some aspects of this, and the stuff she had figured out was confirmed by these Panama Papers leaking.
Yeah. So back in February of 2016, she was talking about this guy, Conrad Mizzi, or Mizzi. He was a Maltese government minister, and he had connections, or at least she's hinting that he had connections to New Zealand and Panama. Two of the places that we found in the Panama Papers were laundering money, or at least involved in some of those things. And then apparently Mizzi revealed the trust just 2 days after she started hinting at this stuff. And he was claiming that it was meant to manage his family's assets, which is one of like his involvement with these things.
Sure.
And that is one very common thing that we see. The very, very wealthy a lot of times have assets that are tied up in familial relations,
right?
Inheritance, things sure. like that. Massive amounts of money. And they have to be protected and it's okay.
All right.
I'm just trying to be nice.
Yeah, I get it. That same month, though, in February, this journalist also revealed that the prime minister's chief of staff, a guy named Keith Shembri, and the prime minister is Joseph Muscat at this time, owned a similar trust in New Zealand, which in turn held a Panamanian shell company. The leak confirmed that Mizzi, Conrad Mizzi owned a company called Hernville Incorporated, and that Mizzi and this guy Shembri had also opened another company, Tilgate Incorporated. These companies were owned by the Orion Trust New Zealand Limited, which are the same trustees of Mizzi and Shembri's New Zealand Trust and a couple of other things.
Yeah. So again, that sounds really confusing.
Sure, yeah.
Basically, these guys opened front companies or shell corporations, not necessarily front companies, those are different things, but they're shell corporations that exist in these other other countries, and that's what we know, right? For that's sure.
That's what we know. That is proven. That is true. And again, Galicia was the person who exposed this information in Malta. And she continued. In 2017, she alleged that another Panamanian company called Agrant was owned by Michelle Muscat, the wife of the prime minister. These allegations are what ostensibly compelled Muscat to call general elections in 2017, and he still won. He still won the election.
Yeah.
The last blog post that Galicia leaves, or the last sentence of the last blog post that she would ever write, says, "There are crooks everywhere you look now. The situation is desperate."
Then on October 16th, 2017, it was the last time Matthew Caruna Galiza saw his mother alive. This is her son. Mm. She was out running errands. She was just heading to the bank in her car. It was a gray Peugeot 108. It's a type of vehicle. And apparently a government minister had gotten the courts, you know, perhaps out of some kind of backlash. I don't know. But he had gotten the courts to freeze her bank accounts, and she was intending to fight for access to her funds because it's her money. Then her son, seemingly out of nowhere, heard an explosion. He was only about 80 meters away from where this explosion occurred. And according to Matthew, he immediately knew, at least he felt at least, that this was a car bomb and it was meant for his mother.
Yes, which is something that sounds like maybe a strange conclusion to jump to right away.
I imagine there had to have been some outward, I don't want to say paranoia. I mean, I'm sure it would manifest from the outside as paranoia, but from the inside, it was just knowing the truth of her situation, maybe.
This was also not the first time, even that year, that a car bomb had been used as a tool of assassination. This was the sixth time. There would have been five more car bombing attacks, some with survivors, from one in January, September, October. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was a messy, messy business. What we're saying is he would have also already have heard about something like a car bomb being used this way.
So he's standing there. This explosion occurs. He's only 80 meters away. He starts running down the road. He's barefoot. He's frantically calling his mother's cell phone. He heard a car horn blazing. He smelled burning fuel. And then he saw it. It was his mom's car. It was on fire, and it was just sitting there on fire in a field of wildflowers, and he apparently saw pieces of flesh laying on the ground, and he certainly feared the worst, and he was right. And then Matthew, her son, recounted this horrific scene in a social media post. In there, you know, within that post, he's speaking to the authorities in a negative manner, saying that they allowed for this culture of impunity to fester inside Malta, saying that this guy, Joseph Muscat, these other people that we've mentioned, Keith Shembri, Chris Cardona, Conrad Mizzi, even the Attorney General, Peter Gretsch, and basically this huge list of police commissioners, he was saying all of these people took no action. And he was saying that they were complicit in her death.
It's true that being a journalist is, globally speaking, a dangerous business. Dozens of journalists are murdered every year around the world. And usually we're seeing that happen in places that are war zones or spheres of conflict or countries with a weak rule of law or weak protections for freedom of speech. This was a massive shock to a lot of people in the West because the European Union considers itself a haven for journalism in many ways. So this felt blatant, public, and grisly. It was not just meant to remove a person, much like polonium poisoning. It was meant to send a message. And I'm making the polonium reference not to say that this was a Russian manufactured hit, but just to say, you know, there was visibility was meant to be part of it. It was condemned in editorials from some of the most widely followed, well-respected news sources around the world. You know, all the hits, the New York Times, CNN, Financial Times, The Guardian, The Economist, I believe. After her death, an international consortium of journalists launched the Daphne Project, which was coordinated by Forbidden Stories. Forbidden Stories is a Paris-based organization dedicated to continuing the work of killed or imprisoned journalists. Even Julian Assange weighed in.
Yeah, he announced that he was going to pay 20,000 euro, a reward essentially, for any information leading to the conviction of Karuna Galiza's killers. That's a huge deal that Julian Assange would step up and do that. Galiza's family then filed a legal claim against the police force in Malta, and they allege that the investigation or whatever investigation is occurring has not been independent or impartial because of connections between a senior police investigator and a government minister. Because, again, all those people she implicated and had things to say about, they have the potential to have influence within the law enforcement sphere. And both were subjects of Karuna Galiza's blog. Exactly.
And where does this leave us now? So the facts so far are that the Panama Papers leak, they confirm what a longtime investigative journalist slash activist has said in the country of Malta. And after numerous attempts on her life, she dies. One of the murder attempts works. So what happens next? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. So fast forward, 10 people were arrested in raids at dawn on December 4th, 2017 in relation to this murder investigation, which was at the time quite controversial because the journalists around the world and journalist support associations, the survivors of Galiza's death, they all are convinced that there is a cover-up afoot, and you can't really blame them. Eventually, 3 people were charged for the murder, for committing the act of rigging a car bomb and detonating it. And his brothers named George and Alfred Di Giorgio and Vincent Muscat. Despite all these protests in Malta and abroad, it appeared that the government of the country was indeed, factually, was actually dragging its feet in the investigation. The 3 suspects claimed their arrest and searches violated their fundamental rights, which in practice worked as a way of delaying the trial.
Yes.
And now it leads us to the Panama Papers in 2019. Because years after the leak, you have to wonder how much this has actually changed the situation on the ground. It's something you and I talked about in the first episode of the papers. I mean, these things blow up, right? And this information is revealed, but those shell companies, except for a few egregious ones, are still around.
Yeah. It definitely reminds me of the financial crash of 2007-2008, where we as a human people saw the cracks in the system and the blatant holes in the system and the way the machine itself was rigged. And yet nothing really changed. I think there was one arrest I know of, and maybe there are a handful of arrests in that situation. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with the Panama Papers. There was a man named Richard Gaffney. He lived in Massachusetts. He was an accountant. He was apprehended in 2018 in December. That was the first arrest occurred from the Panama Papers in the U.S.
Yeah.
in December of 2018. I mean, There have been a handful of people who have gotten in various levels of trouble throughout the world because of the Panama Papers. Some politicians have stepped down at least in part due to the Panama Papers coming out, or at least had to apologize. I remember when David Cameron had this whole story. It was the same thing with, you know, this is my family's money and it's just in a trust and we're just moving it around.
But, you know, Vegas, baby.
Yeah, there we go.
That was what Cameron said.
Yes.
Said it's mostly his blackjack money.
Yeah. But the United States is different from in Malta. It's different from New Zealand. It's different from in Panama where it's actually occurring. And in Malta, there is a clear issue.
Yes. We'll put it simply. The people who are in charge of investigating this murder are the people that Galizia was investigating when she was alive.
Yeah.
Or they're closely affiliated with the people that she accused of cover-ups, crime, and even things ranging into support of violent crime.
It's like a waterfall of paychecks, basically. Mm. Who signs your paycheck? Well, it goes all the way up. Oh, yep, it's that guy.
Turtles all the way down. Yeah. And – or terror all the way down, perhaps. And you can't blame people for saying there's something screwy with this investigation. The prime minister continued to pursue a libel case against Galizia after she was dead, and said he would drop it if everyone agreed that he
that he's cool and he didn't do anything.
Right. Right. And I'm laughing with a bitter note here because, you see, at this point, it's widely agreed that these three men who are currently in custody for this crime, it's widely agreed that they were not the brains behind the operation. They are all slightly older, low-level criminals. Mostly known for their activity in the diesel smuggling business, which is a big business in Malta.
Yeah.
So who is at the top? You know, someone who would be we were looking then, in that case, we're looking for someone who fits a couple of descriptions or a couple of profiles. We're looking for someone who has enough money or enough, you know, financial clout such that they would be a subject of something in the Panama Papers.
Yes.
They have to be shell company rich, right?
Probably not an elected official. It might be a one step removed from an elected official.
Sure, yeah. It might be somebody who bought a passport. Who knows? Mm. And travels internationally.
Ooh.
But they're somehow involved in Maltese business because otherwise Galizia wouldn't have run up against them. You know
That's
what I
right.
mean? So it's someone who is probably on an international sphere, maybe in politics, but definitely closely related to someone in politics. Let's say they at the very least have an interest in Maltese governance, right?
Or some regulations.
Mm-hmm. And they're not the type of person to go out and rig a car bomb themselves. They probably or quite possibly, not to be unfair to this horrific excuse for a person, but they probably don't know how to rig a car bomb.
I would agree with that.
So the investigation and the cover-up continues. We mentioned earlier these three criminals had said their rights were violated. As of February 2019, when we're recording this, it seems that the trial may finally begin. That's right, begin.
Yeah. And it's so – it's good, right? That was 2017 when they argued that their rights were being violated. Now, 2 years later, the investigation is going on. The police are actually trying to find more suspects connected with the murder. Mm-hmm. So trying to go up that chain to see who actually ordered it. And this includes people who are suspected to be linked with the commissioning. That's like we said, the – not the putting together the bomb but the commissioning of the bomb. And – foreign investigators have questioned the reluctance of the Maltese police to kind of keep this trial going and make it happen. And they've also questioned the reluctance of them to proceed against more suspects because that's where it could get really tricky.
Right.
For the police themselves.
That's where you get a little True Detective season one, right?
Yeah.
Following up the chain, up the food chain of crime. Yeah, it's believed that there may be between 3 and 5 other people who are known to the police or known to law enforcement but have not been publicly revealed. The argument being that they're not slowing up the investigation on purpose. They just need to gather more evidence. At this point, again, it's a controversial thing. A lot of people don't believe the story. A lot of European news outlets still follow the investigation and the trial. There's an Italian daily paper called La Repubblica, and it's been following a it's been barking up a specific theory tree that may be of interest to people who are familiar with this case or just learning about it. The suspects in the murder, the diesel fuel smugglers, which again seems a very strange and specific type of crime, they apparently, according to this paper, have a connection with someone called Christian Cardona, Malta's current Minister of Economics, economy minister. In the weeks leading up to Galizia's assassination, this guy, Christian Cardona, was spotted in a remote bar on Malta twice with one of the guys who was later charged with detonating the car bomb. Cardona responded, calling this report baseless conjecture and outright fabrication. Officially, Kurt Ferrugia, spokesperson for the Maltese government, stated, "The government is confident that anyone else responsible will be found and brought to justice. We continue to support all efforts by the police and investigating magistrate to find the truth. Malta is committed to upholding human rights, freedom of speech, the protection of journalists, and the rule of law."
Whoa.
Who doesn't agree?
Sounds like great PR. but, you know, Galizia's family does not agree with this, I think fairly obviously. And we know this because Matthew, her son, was quoted in The Atlantic, who, by the way, Matthew is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. Pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. Apple did not fall far from the tree there. But he, Matthew, and his two brothers have been lobbying European lawmakers and like all these international organizations for months and months and months trying to call attention to problems within the investigation itself. So let's look at that quote. Matthew said, "My mother was assassinated for reporting on corruption in Malta." And he also sent out a tweet on the anniversary of her death. He said, "The people who did it are still free. They sit in parliament and on private jets. It's this simple." Wow.
Yeah, it's heavy hitting. The investigation continues, as does, on some level, the cover-up.
Absolutely.
Some people are a little more optimistic than others and think that ultimately the brains behind the operation will be named or brought to justice. But for many other people, unfortunately, this is just another day in Malta.
Oof.
I know, not to sound Chinatown about it.
Well, and it's also another day in the upper echelons of power and influence.
That's true. That is absolutely true. At this point, that's where the story ends for now. It continues, and hopefully one day we can come back with an update showing that justice was served. But for now, we want to hear from you. Why do you think these financial crimes and these sorts of assassinations come and go so quickly in the news? Why do you think there's not more following up on the Panama Papers here in the United States?
Yeah, please. We want to know those things. Do you think it had something to do with the connection or maybe a crossroad somewhere between politics and organized crime?
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to hear from you. If you know anything, be very careful about writing to us, but we would love to hear it. You know, if not, send it to a journalist somewhere within your country. Just do it carefully.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to find us on social media and connect with us that way. We are at Conspiracy Stuff in most places, at Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Ben, you have a personal Instagram?
That's true. It is at Ben Bolin. In a burst of unbridled creativity.
At Ben Bolin, HSW. No, it's at Ben Bolin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's
mm-hmm.
awesome. I am not, I have one, but you will never find it.
Right. Right. It's enormously difficult to locate.
You don't want to see it. It's just pictures of my son and I. And if you don't want to connect with us that way, you can find our Facebook group.
Ah, yes. Here's where it gets crazy, where you can hang out with our favorite part of the show, your fellow listeners. It's also a great spot to pitch us some ideas for future topics or to get some feedback from other people about a weird thing you saw in the news. Because it's cool to crowdsource that kind of fact-checking. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
And we have the greatest mods on the planet.
And we have some top-notch mods.
That's right.
Their moddery is beyond compare. And let's say you're someone who says, yeah, I've got something you need to know.
Yeah.
I want to tell you, but I'm more of an audio person.
Mm.
Well, we have good news for you. You can call us directly.
We are 1-833-STDWYTK. That's right. It's not that creepy. It's just an acronym for stuff they don't want you to know. And it becomes numbers when you type it in your phone. You'll see. Okay, so leave us a message there. We will listen to it, and it might get on the show if you make it weird enough. Like, make it super weird.
Oh, wow. You're opening the door, my friend.
Get creative with it is what I'm saying.
Yeah. If none of that quite bagged your badgers, have no fear. We are still squarely in the world of email. You can write to us directly. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.